Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
The Jeopardy category was authors. The clue? She wrote about bodily functions and other disgusting stuff. The response? Who is Sylvia Branzi? Sylvia Branzi teaches science through gross things. She has a BA in microbiology and an MA in science education, and she is the originator of grossology. Her book, Grossology, was translated into a dozen languages and made it into museum exhibits, which she co-designed. She has delighted and educated children and adults throughout the United States and Canada, Germany, and England. She's been interviewed and featured in news magazines and newspapers like Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, San Francisco Chronicle, LA Times, Washington Post, and on CNN, NBC, and CBS, and the BBC. Sylvia Branzi has written 5 books in her international best-selling Grossology series. She's also the author of Ixtory series and co-author of Dinosaur Store, Outer Space Place, and the soap opera Science on Stage anthology. She lives in Southern Oregon with her husband Byron Velasquez, a dog and 2 cats. She's in Chico for the spring exhibit of Grossology at the Gateway Science Museum. Sylvia Branzi, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you're in Chico because of this exhibit at the Gateway Science Museum. And I saw this exhibit, and it is just captivating in so many ways.
That's a great word. It's not gross, though.
No, not really. You're right. And it's interactive.
Very. That was one of our points, was that everything had to be very interactive for the children. Our real goal was that when kids left, they go, oh, I love science. I want to do more science.
In fact, Jennifer Jewell, who has a program here on North State Public Radio, she hosts a radio program, said that 6 years ago, her 14-year-old daughter at 8 became a fan of your work. And she, 6 years later at 14, she's still excited about it.
Yay.
Now, that would be something I think would be really a goal of yours, that it would be so impressive that these children that come through your exhibit now, years later, are going to be excited about science because of your work.
That is the definite goal, and I guess I'm succeeding.
So where did you come up with the idea of studying gross things?
It was an epiphany. I was home, and I was clipping my toenails. And I started thinking about the gunk underneath my toenails. And then since I majored in microbiology, I thought, Sylvia, you can figure this out. And it hit me. Whoa, kids like gross stuff. I'm going to teach them science. I'll invent a new science. I'll call it grossology. And I did it right then and there and started thinking, wow, getting a list together. And that night over spaghetti dinner, my husband was there, my 2 stepchildren. I mentioned it, and they said, that's a great idea. The stepkids were 8 and 13. So perfect age to fly an idea by. They start coming up with lists, and grossology was just born that day.
Well, now, at that time, were you actually teaching? Because you did teach for a while.
I wasn't teaching in a regular classroom. I was teaching after-school science enrichment courses, and I was also working at a creative reuse center, designing curriculum for recycling and creative reuse.
So you come up with this idea to introduce children to this notion that that's science. Gross things, that's science.
It's my hook. and the hook worked for various reasons. I've thought a lot about that.
So in your exhibit, there's one that's called Let's Play Grossology. And so they get to play that. A lot of them, they're pushing buttons. And then there's a professor, Nigel Knows It All. And I just stood in front of Professor Knows It All, his nose. He's actually, will you describe?
He's
Professor
a giant animatronic faucet head guy who has an English accent.
He even has an English, he's a faucet, but I looked at his lips, his teeth, and they looked very British.
He's very British. And he answers all kinds of information or talks about snot. And every so often it's a balloon, basically. But a glob of snot comes out of his nose and he sucks it back up, but he's very proper about all of it. And he's wearing a awesome bathrobe.
Yes.
That's a character from the Grossology book that was made like giant animatronic, bigger than life guy. And yeah. They named him Nigel Knows It All.
Knows, spelling N-O-S-E.
Yes.
Knows it all. And when you're writing your books, there's a lot of scientific information in there. It's fun. But where did you get your information? Because you did a lot of research. I was quite impressed. Because your books, because they're illustrated like children's books, you think, oh, well, there'll be a few words per page. No, you've got packed with information. So how did you research this information?
A lot. Well, when the first book came out, there was no World Wide Web. I spent a lot of time in the library. I used a lot of medical textbooks, nursing books. I had friends that were nurses, so I would call them. I would back everything up. Everything had to be backed up by at least two sources. So I couldn't just suddenly pick info from one place and use it because I didn't feel comfortable with that. So I poured over all my information. I needed accuracy. And then it was all, obviously, all the facts were checked by my publisher as well.
Well, now, when it comes to gross things, of those two groups you mentioned medical text and nursing text, I think it's the nurses who really have to get their hands dirty.
And their textbooks dealt with all the icky stuff even more than the medical background books. It was amazing. Or I could call my sister, who was in school to be a nurse at the time, or my friend, who was a RN, and ask them questions that they could answer that weren't quite in the books.
Well, did you get pick their brain for topics? Because you could pick up one of your books and you don't have to read them sequentially. You could just open it to some topic and read that. So did they make suggestions? Hey, Sylvia, here's a topic to include.
My topics came from the horse's mouths. My stepchildren, who were kids, came up with topics. Later on, I was teaching in a remote rural school in Humboldt County, and my students came up with all my topics, and then they were junior high school age. And after that, sometimes children would write me letters and come up with topics. So I wanted to get topics that I thought that kids would love. On occasion, I added things that I was fascinated in, because like that gunk in your eyes we call sleep, I've never known what made it, and that's always bugged me. So I had to do it for my own personal satisfaction.
Yeah, that's not something really in when you're going through your curriculum in microbiology and getting your degree. It's not something that they teach you.
I found that info in a textbook for optometrists.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
It did.
Well, some of the topics, for example, one of your books is called Grossology and You, Really Gross Things About Your Body. And you cover, for example, athlete's foot in that book, constipation. Well, in fact, while we're on that, you give tips as to what you should do and what you shouldn't do if you suffer from constipation.
Oh, yes, of course.
Did you research that? I'm sure you did.
Oh, of course. You know, fiber, water, don't strain, goes on and on. Anything, and that's just pretty normal information, but I feel terrible if I wrote something and didn't explain how to take care of it for yourself. Because really, a lot of it's health education in disguise.
Exactly. Yeah. And put in that book. Also in that book, you mentioned knuckle cracking.
Because so many people do that. And everyone used to say, oh, if you crack your knuckles, you're going to get arthritis. And I cracked my knuckles. And it was on my list for my students because they thought it was really disgusting, some of them.
Oh, really?
So
I thought you were going to say that the adults in their families, oh, no, don't do that. You'll hurt your hands, or that's bad for your hands.
No, the kids wanted to know. And that actually, Grossology and You is our advanced grossology book. And it covered a lot of the topics that we just didn't get a chance to cover in the other books. And knuckle cracking was on that list for a long time.
Well, you also use the word vile describing it, and you say in your book that's a fancy word for disgusting, that something is vile. And you say, I didn't realize that this many people, you said one out of four people are knuckle crackers?
Yeah, there's a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
Do you crack your knuckles?
No, I don't. I don't think I could get mine to crack.
Oh, really? I crack my knuckles all the time.
I don't know that I would know how to go about that.
Really? It just happens, see?
Oh.
I just crack all on their own.
Well, you have in your book, too, things that I think are easy for children to, I don't know if you'd call them experiments, but in that section on knuckle cracking, you show them how they can see their tendons.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool because it's so simple.
It is so simple. And I was surprised that I never looked at my wrists that way. Describe how children can look at their tendons.
Well, it's basically a method of looking at them by wiggling your fingers in certain orders because then you can see what your tendons are attached to. Why, what did you learn? You tell us.
Well, that I normally don't look at my wrist when I'm moving my fingers. And so I moved the fingers individually and just watched the sequence of tendons in the wrists.
Isn't that cool? I was just doing it the other day, actually, because I was trying to figure out why my hand was hurting. Mm-hmm. And I was watching all my tendons as I moved my fingers.
And mine are quite visible in the back. The inside of my wrist, I can see them move, but the back, I can quite see them quite easily.
Wow, I have to use I use the inside of my hand.
I think, though, that then a child who's studying, say, ligaments and tendons would never forget, I know the difference in a ligament and a tendon now because I've seen it. I've seen tendons in action in my own hand and wrist.
Well, once you bring something home, you remember it. And that's, it's their own body. They're looking at it. So it's really going to stick to them because how much more home can you get than your own body?
Yeah, to look at your own hand and see, the tendons here. And you say that the label double-jointed, that some people are double, that we call them double-jointed, but what are they really?
What they are is that they just have slippery ligaments.
So they
stretch more easily. Their tendons and ligaments are going to be stretchier, or they're not quite. Stretchy isn't really the word I want. They're loose. They're more loosely attached compared to other people.
And you say long ligaments.
Right.
And often other people who are not, say, double-jointed like that are envious. Oh, you're so flexible. And yet I think that people who are so-called double-jointed have to be more careful to develop strength.
Exactly. Because they're so long that it's not as easy for people that have us who aren't double-jointed, are attached together more closely. And so you have to develop your strength because obviously when you have really long tendons holding everything together, ligaments, then it's going to be harder for you to build up the strength with everywhere else.
My guest is Sylvia Bransey, and she has written a series of books on the science of gross things. She's also written got a couple of books on ixtery. I'm pronouncing it. That's the word because it's a play on the word history.
Right.
And what did you write about ixtery?
We did two books so far, and one was on vampires, and the other one was on mummies. And we were just trying to, as in my illustrator and I, we work as a team. And we were just having fun one day on the phone talking about pirates, actually. And we were like, man, I want to do a book on pirates. And then we made that, wow, what other cool things could we do? Oh, wow, what should we name this series? And we came up with ixtery one day. And these are more beginning readers. So they're for the youngins.
Yeah. And in fact, you mentioned on the book, you have one that is labeled level 3 and one level 4.
Right. The level 4 is they've been re-released so that they would be level 4s in the current release.
And you might mention the name of your illustrator since you...
Jack Keeley. He's the best. When I wrote my first book, you're assigned an illustrator. You don't get to pick your illustrator. And he was doing all the illustrations for Planet Dexter, which is a series under Penguin Putnam. And my publisher said, your illustrator is going to be Jack Keeley. Oh, look, and he sent me books of what Jack had drawn, and it was cute little bunny rabbits. And I'm like, oh, my word, no way. And I called Jack up, and I said, you're going to illustrate my books? These are grossology books. And Jack said that he set out to prove that he could do it.
And that so he could be as gross as anybody.
And cute, though. See,
they are cute.
The point.
Yes, and so, they're appealing.
So if a baby, farts or barfs in a book, you go, oh, that's so cute. And as opposed to being disgusted. And then later on, you're going, oh, my word, I can't believe I said that. So he wanted to combine that cuteness grossness. And we really avoided being just disgusting because we're not into that, really. Yeah. So they're hilarious. His illustrations are really, really funny.
And the exhibit at the Gateway Science Museum brings to life 3 dimensions Jack's illustrations.
Yes. A lot of the characters from the books were turned into animatronics, or they're, on the backs of the exhibits, and they're giant. It thrilled Jack and myself to see our books become 3D images of themselves.
three-dimensional.
Is that cool or what?
It is. And some of your books, even the covers are tactilely interesting because there's one that has some barf on the cover.
The original books, when they were released. So the original books, the Grossology book had fake vomit on the cover. And the Animal Grossology book had fake bird poop on the cover. And Grossology Begins at Home had a giant fake cockroach on the cover. What happened was that libraries couldn't get the books. School libraries or libraries, public libraries, because the kids would peel the fake whatever off. Yeah. So they were re-released later with proper bindings and no fake stuff on the cover.
But kind of raised, it was still, you can kind of feel, some of them, you can feel the...
They're still a little bit tactile. Yeah.
But going back to the one with the cockroach on it, it even feels icky.
Oh, yeah.
That cockroach is made out of a kind of plastic. You're like, oh, gosh, I feel like I'm feeling an actual cockroach. And it's also huge. So I wondered how librarians would put a book like that on your shelf.
They couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. But it's such a fun idea.
Oh, it was a great idea. And it got us recognized. School teachers would write me and say that they would have contests for at the end of the year if the whatever was still attached to the cover.
If the cockroach was still
there,
the
they would have a pizza party.
Ah, so that way they encourage the kids, please don't peel off the cockroach.
Exactly. So it was causing some problems, but it was pretty fun.
Well, in that book, speaking of cockroach, since you had it on the cover, inside this book, the cockroach is on. You talk about how to have a pet cockroach.
Yep.
You want to flip to that? Do you remember that? It's on page 51.
Oh, yeah. I actually tell kids how to go about if they want to have pet cockroaches, how to go about. I actually met somebody who had pet cockroaches.
And so they were your source.
Right.
Here's how to
have a pet cockroach. And at some museums, on the cover, it's like a giant hissing cockroach. And some museums have hissing cockroaches as pets. And then I met somebody who had a hissing cockroach as a pet. And then somebody else who just had pet cockroaches. He wrote books about it, actually. Well, he was into cockroaches.
How do you tame a cockroach?
Well, you don't really tame a cockroach. But the giant hissing cockroaches, I mean, they're huge. And there's one in Seattle in the museum, and you would pet it, and it would, like, make this like little chirping noise.
So this cockroach on the cover of your book is life size? I thought it was an exaggeration.
Oh, no.
Your cockroach is that large.
Okay. Yeah, Madagascar giant hissing cockroaches.
Well, before you tell us how to have a pet cockroach, let me remind listeners, my guest is Sylvia Branzi, and she has a series of books on the science of grossology. And in one of her books, she tells us how we can have a pet cockroach.
Well, it's pretty easy, really. If you want a pet cockroach, you go to somewhere where there's cockroaches. And then you put out a plate with some yummy stuff on it, because cockroaches like yummy stuff. And then you put a little bit of petroleum jelly on the plate. That's the tricky part, because you want to trap your cockroach.
Get his feet stuck in the petroleum jelly.
And well, then you really don't want cockroaches running around your house so much. So then I have the kids like put them in a jar and poke holes in the jar and put their cockroach in the jar.
So after the cockroach is trapped in the petroleum jelly, it gets transferred to a jar.
Exactly, so they aren't running around the house. But some people I know, they transfer their cockroaches to, they're like shoeboxes, plastic ones, with the big top so the cockroach would have more room to run around in. If you're into having whole crews of cockroaches.
And when you say they are social creatures, if you see one, it's not going to be just one by himself.
Yeah, you probably catch a few.
Yeah.
And if they reproduce, you'll have many. And your mother won't like it if you release them in the house.
You even mentioned the cities where you're more likely to encounter cockroaches. That's on page 46 in there. And that kind of surprised me because I thought there would be, like, cities in Florida would be at the top of the list. But they weren't really.
Well, the big cities are going to be at the top of your list.
Right. But what were the cities that people are more likely to find a cockroach?
L.A.
Yeah.
When I lived there, there were cockroaches.
Yeah.
I remember because I lived in L.A., and they would just come in the house because they were all over the place. New York City, of course, because
that's
just so crowded.
That didn't surprise me at all, New York. But then the other places were in Texas.
That doesn't surprise me. It's rather warm. It's humid.
Yeah.
Lots of cockroaches there.
Yeah.
Florida, yeah, but you got to remember, we're talking cockroaches. Remember how they change names, like Louisiana, they call them palmetto bugs. Florida, they're not called cockroaches. They're called palmetto bugs. And I'll be going, my foot, that's a cockroach. They just change the names.
Okay, so this book, why don't you, in fact, while you have that book there in front of you, just read the introduction to this book that Grossology Begins at Home as an example of the introductions to your other grossology books.
Yes, grossology does begin at home too, as does all science. There's a whole world of grossness right under your nose, your eyes, and your feet. Just when you thought you were safe, grossology moved in. Yep, nowhere is sacred for a grossologist, and your home is a perfect laboratory for the science of really putrid things. Take a tour of your little house of grossness. Around every corner is a yucky discovery, and every nook and cranny is a disgusting surprise. Even your body is home to invisible, icky creatures. Face it, there's no use in hiding. There's no escape. You can't run or fight it. Grossology begins at home. During a single day, you encounter gobs of sickening things. Most of the time, you overlook them. Now it's time to embrace them, to truly love the foul in your life. Let go and let grossology in.
Sylvia Brancy is reading from her book, Grossology Begins at Home, and currently there is an exhibit at the Gateway Science Museum in Chico, an exhibit of gross things that Sylvia has designed. Now, you have used these topics to get children interested in science, but I find that it's just as exciting for adults.
We have found that actually through the ages. When people would write me often, it'd be an auntie or somebody would write and say, oh, I bought this book for my niece, nephew. I ended up keeping it and buying them another because there's a lot of information we don't know.
Yeah, and you don't want to bring it up with your doctor because some of it you're kind of embarrassed to talk about to your doctor.
And now you can just learn about it right here.
Yeah.
I know it really is funny how much we don't know about our own bodies and the world around us, things that we have avoided learning about.
Yeah. And in your books, too, you give little experiments that children can do.
And adults,
yeah, because I think the adults would probably be just as eager to do it. For example, I don't think anybody would ever think of testing the toilet paper, but you have a way to test toilet paper.
Oh, yeah.
In that book.
Oh, I know that. I've done that with children at different schools and museums. Well, the real point of testing your toilet paper is to find out which ones are, so to speak, strongest, or you want to find out which one is most cost-effective. That one is a good idea. Or what you have value in your toilet paper. And so you're going to take toilet paper, different brands, and put a little bit of water on it and use washers or weights and see which one would hold the most weight or which one even holds the most water. Although when I recently did this with a group for a summer camp, they actually decided that recycled toilet paper was best no matter what, even though it didn't succeed in the
it
weight
didn't
test,
perform
as well.
So recycled paper in toilet paper didn't perform as well, but the kids were so eager to be good citizens, if I want to call it that, and take care of the environment, that they said, even if this toilet paper is less effective, we're going to buy the recycled.
Which I thought was really neat that they came to that conclusion, because we made sure we had recycled in there and all different kinds. And they were like, well, yeah, this one. But really, I think we'll still buy recycled. I just thought it was adorable that they came up with their own solution, but still took in all the data and all the information.
They took in the information, but then drew their own conclusions from that. That's great. In this same book, you have a section on cavities. And one of the statements in there that you refute, you have a quote, I don't eat candy, but I still have cavities. So if it isn't candy, if it isn't sugar, then why do we get cavities?
We're going to get it from...
Because parents are probably telling their kids,
don't eat that
candy because you'll get...
You get it from carbohydrates. Any kind of breads and stuff because they're going to break down and make...
This is on page 32.
And they're going to make sugars inside of your mouth. So you got to stay away from all kinds of starches, actually. Because a long, long time ago, like, ancient peoples didn't have cavities, which I thought was pretty cool, actually. So we have them because we eat a lot of, well, we do eat sugar, but we go ahead, we eat starches, and then our mouth is just filled with these bacteria, and bacteria like chomp, chomp, oh, yummy, yummy, chomp, 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 chomp.
In fact, you say that then these bacteria, and then what creates the problem is they create acid.
Yeah, well, they're just like bacteria pee-pee, you know, and it's acidic and it eats away at your teeth, which is amazing, really.
Now, in your book, too, you include historical notes that are interesting. For example, right now we have Crest and we have all these toothpastes. But if you go back, say, to the early 1800s, when there was no Crest, how did people clean their teeth?
That was the ground bone, right?
Yeah, this is on page 33.
She's like, wait a minute, this has been a long time since I read this book. Yeah. Oh, eggshells and fish scales. That's right. Eggshells and fish scales. So if you run out of toothpaste, you can just use eggshells and fish scales.
To brush your teeth. And then Hippocrates suggested to his, Hippocrates, the famous Greek physician, he said, brush your teeth with ground marble.
Right, and that would work great, right?
I suppose so. But
it would take everything out of your mouth.
It makes us appreciate the fact that we just squeezed something out of a tube.
It's many years in the making, actually. Many, many. Well, because people didn't, I mean, originally they didn't use tubes either. They used the powdered.
Right, right. And that's what you were saying, that the tooth powder that people used, the fish scales, and that was ground up fish scales. And
then
eggshells.
They sold tooth powder for a long time.
And it was a powder that you brushed your teeth with. Well, the history notes are very interesting that you have in your book. And I want to ask you about Napoleon. And what was his problem at Waterloo that we never hear about? We hear this great general.
I know.
But he lost the battle at Waterloo. So when we come back for a break, Sylvia, I want you to tell us what happened to poor Napoleon and why he didn't win the Battle of Waterloo. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Sylvia Branzi. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And my guest, Sylvia Branzi, is author of five books, actually, Sylvia, on Grossology.
Yep.
Is that the current count? She has books called Ixtory, Unraveling the Icky History of Mummies or Vampires. And we haven't mentioned, you've got a couple of books with your illustrator, that are designed for children, and I love the titles of them. The Dinosaur Store, The Outer Space Place, and I'm wondering, those kind of musical that appeals to the ear, are you a musician?
Yeah.
What do you play?
Well, actually, I sing.
Oh, you sing?
Yes.
In fact, is that how you met your husband?
Yeah, in a band. It was a folk band, and then we were in various bands. Right now, we have a band called Wacky Dog that does shows for children. Although we did an adult birthday party recently that was really fun. We sing songs about dogs, predominantly our dogs and other dogs. And we wear ears and stuff.
Yeah, because the titles of these children's books were like music to me, because the way they rhyme, The Dinosaur Store and The Outer Space Place. Okay, before we went to break, I said that I was going to ask you What happened to Napoleon?
Yeah, he had a big problem.
Now, how do you know about this? Because I don't think history books want to tell you this.
Napoleon. They really don't want to tell you this. But what happened is, through history, people did look at Napoleon in history, what he ate, what his medical problems were, given historical background. And he had a problem with hemorrhoids. And hemorrhoids can be very, very painful. And so, given that Waterloo was a bit of a problem, and he also invented canned foods. That's how they were.
Defeat supplies army.
Right, which is part of the reason they were so successful. But they probably added to his hemorrhoids. And so he had a flare-up of hemorrhoids on the day of the battle. And so he just wasn't focused very well on the battle, they think. And that was part of his pile of defeat. Is due to his piles caused a pile of defeat.
And piles is another word for hemorrhoids. And you even have a note about the origin of that word.
And it makes sense.
It does.
Because hemorrhoids are round. They're little circles. And the word actually comes from the Latin word for ball. Or pila, is that how you say it in Latin?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, so you have a little note that it was the Romans who gave us that word indirectly.
Exactly.
Other word. So you have a chapter on hemorrhoids.
Of course.
And something I never thought to wonder about was whether other animals got them. But you say, no, we're the only animal.
Yeah, they don't get hemorrhoids.
So why I guess you must have ideas about why it's people and not other animals.
Well, it's because of what we eat. Because we don't necessarily eat foods that our bodies can process very well. We don't eat enough roughage. We eat a lot of processed foods, and then actually the part isn't really in the book, but the other reason that we get hemorrhoids is because we sit on toilets, and toilets really aren't the best way to defecate or poop.
You mean sit as opposed to being elevated instead of squatting? Is that what
right,
you mean?
Right, as mm-hmm. opposed to squatting, because when you squat, you can actually relieve yourself more easily because our body is more designed to do that.
In
so
fact,
it's all the
toilets
combo.
Are going the opposite way to accommodate people in wheelchairs. They are raising the level. So
right.
even less
right.
sitting
less,
position.
Less sitting position. You're less low as mm-hmm. as you should be, actually, if you want to poop properly. Proper pooping position.
Or more naturally, perhaps.
Or more naturally. Because mm-hmm. in some countries, they just have like holes in the floor and you squat. I should have looked that up to see what the rate of like hemorrhoids and constipation would be.
In different
in
countries.
In countries where they would squat more. I'll just store that in the back of my head and probably go home and research it to find out.
Okay, so we're still in this book. Grossology Begins at Home. And you have a chapter on hemorrhoids. You also have a chapter on kitty litter. And one of the sketches that Jack Keeley, your illustrator, did was a kitty cat on a toilet.
People can train their cats to go on the toilet.
Have you ever, because you have a couple of cats, don't you?
Our cats go outside. I don't do kitty litter because it's.
So you've never tried?
No, but I have. I actually met one person in my grossology years who had trained their cat to go on a toilet. After I've written that, I've found people that online then that said that they had done it. And I actually met somebody whose cat went to the bathroom on the toilet. I thought that was
pretty cool.
Because
you said you didn't want to include anything unless you had more than one sort that wasn't true
exactly.
in your books.
You know, new info I found about kitty litter, though, recently, is that there are these kind of parasites that live inside kitty poo. And so what happens is that the cats they have this kind of parasite, this protozoa inside. And if a rat smells cat poo, it actually changes its brain chemistry. So it gets attracted to cats, and then the cat gets to kill the rat, right? They found out that this same kind of parasite can get into humans, especially because of kitty litter. And it affects our brain chemistry. And so that people, sometimes you go in their house and it smells like kitty litter and kitty pee-pee, and they don't even notice because that parasite is working on them, and it makes them a little bit crazy. So the crazy cat lady really is.
So that crazy old maid aunt could be crazy because of her cat and its cat litter.
Yes.
Oh, my.
So if I were writing the book now, I would have added that. But that's just new information that just came out in the last year.
Well, you have, we mentioned the chapter on cockroaches, and you said that actually cockroaches can live for weeks without food.
Oh, yeah, forever and ever. Cockroaches can survive because they have their own fat stores. And so that's why when we all get wiped out, the cockroaches will keep
that's
on
what
living.
We've often heard, yeah.
Yeah, and that's
every,
true.
All other life forms get wiped out on Earth, the cockroaches
it'll be the cockroach because they can just live forever and ever and ever without any food.
Well, speaking of food and what is in food, we read a label and we see citric acid and we think, oh, citric acid, that comes from lemons or oranges. And you say in your book that's not what citric acid comes from.
I don't even remember. What
this
is
it? This is on page 56
in
your
look it
book.
Up.
And you say that citric acid is made by a black
mold. Oh, the
mold.
That's right.
And Jack Keeley, your illustrator, has some pictures of some oranges there with some
mold on them. But, I mean, mold is just like everywhere. I mean, that's what penicillin really was in the beginning, yeah. too. So it probably didn't stand out because it doesn't faze me.
And we do know that. For
we
example,
just forget it.
If you had a piece of bread with mold on it, it was the only bread you had, Sylvia, would you eat that moldy bread?
I just pull the mold off myself, but...
Well, but so it's not harmful in
no,
that sense.
But
no, not still, at all. If I were eating something that had citric acid in it, I would rather think that its source was a lemon instead of black
there you go. Just
mold.
Keep believing that. Or maybe that's part of the reason I blocked that out of my mind.
My guest is Sylvia Branzi, and she has written a series of books on the topic of grossology, a term for the science of gross things. And she includes in her book experiments that kids can do. And, for example, people might want to scrape their tongue. And if they scrape saliva off their tongue, say with a spoon, they actually have tools for that, some cultures that scrape their tongue. And why would somebody want to do that?
Why would you want to scrape it? Because there's so much gunk and junk on your tongue.
And besides that, you
and
say
you can also like
50 million little creatures.
Oh, more than yeah,
more I mean, than the population of the Earth.
Just on your
on
tongue.
Your tongue.
Oh yeah.
Now, you also say that there was a Berkeley entomologist, UC Berkeley. And you might, I think people know an entomologist is a guy who studies insects.
Yep.
And what kind of dinner, I don't know if they even want to call it dinner, but he prepared some dishes for people to taste. And I don't know if you remember the particular ones that he prepared. This is on page 63.
Oh, yeah. He's the one who did the with worms, the earthworm.
All sorts of creatures that you wouldn't think you'd want to eat, although I've heard serious scientists say that's what we should be doing. We
because
should
it's
be
so
grinding
high in
up insects. Yeah, grind up insects. Countries that don't have a lot of protein, grind up insects and put it in the food.
Well, there's a guy, he's the cockroach guy, and I've seen a lot of people have booked me and him and for shows together, and he cooks with insects. So I've eaten like cricket ouzo or orzo or something kind
pasta.
Of rice. Yeah, cricket pasta. I've eaten chocolate chirp cookies.
Chocolate chirp cookies.
Yes. I haven't had the applesauce earthworm cake or whatever. But I have eaten a lot of foods with bugs that he has cooked with. And he himself, besides insects, is a vegetarian. I mean, he only eats insects.
This professor that you're talking about at UC Berkeley.
Oh, no, this is
the cockroach guy. Well, if you have that page there, page 63, why don't you read that description you include in your book about what this entomologist prepared and had people taste?
It's actually pretty cool.
It is.
So here you go. Bye-bye, 63. I'm more interested in defect action levels all of a sudden. That's on page 63.
Isn't it? Maybe I wrote the page number down.
You did.
Okay,
oh, here
sorry.
We go. Maggot pate. Grasshopper
maggot. Now,
guacamole.
Make sure people heard that. Maggot.
I have had barbecued maggots.
Okay.
Yes.
So
that was a really hard one, though, because I hate maggots.
So what did people think about the maggot pate?
You know, it's funny because insects don't have a lot of flavor. So it's going to take on whatever it's in. Because I've eaten enough of them now at different programs. When you're the grossologist and they say, hey, try this barbecue maggots, you say, thank you very much, and you eat them. And
okay, so we had maggot pate,
grasshopper guacamole. For dessert, that's one. Earthworm and applesauce cake. That's what I really wanted to try, but I've never tried that. And this was actually told to me by a friend of mine, Don, who ate this meal with this professor, who actually Don himself now is a doctor. And so he tasted it, and he said, the maggot pate was like chicken.
Maggots taste like chicken. Now, see,
a little bit.
That sounds like such a cliche. Well, anything strange.
Everything
tastes like chicken.
Yeah. Exactly. Earthworms, he said you didn't even really notice. The grasshopper guacamole, he said that the grasshoppers weren't chopped up enough, so it was kind of super crunchy.
Yeah, I think you'd have to make a really fine powder of grasshoppers.
But in Japan, you can get grasshoppers that are barbecued on sticks, because my husband's had those.
And you mentioned a dish made out of crickets. I would think they would be crunchy also.
They're like very crunchy. They just go crunch, crunch.
You also make points that might surprise people that toilet seats have less bacteria than a kitchen sink.
Oh, by far. I mean, everybody who goes into they go into a public washroom and they cover the toilet seat. I'm like, duh. You know, to be honest, you're going to get a lot more bacteria from opening and closing that door to go in the stall or from the sink itself, from turning on and off the taps. I don't cover the toilet seat, but I cover the taps when I turn them on and off with the water on and off. And I never touch the door when I go in and out for all the people who don't wash their hands after they go pee-pee.
Well, I've seen television reports where they put some chemical on there where they can see it illuminates the bacteria and germs. And they do say what you have said about that you their toilet seats have less bacteria than your own kitchen sink. And you say even the sponge.
Oh, the sponge is the worst. Because think about bacteria. They like kind of warm. They like moist. So we take a sponge. We get some warm water. Then we wipe everything down. Oh, now we fed them. And then we
fed the bacteria.
Yeah, fed the bacteria. They're happy. And then we put the sponge. Oftentimes at my house, they leave it in the sink and I have a fit. So I move it up to dry it out. Or you could put it in the microwave briefly to kill all the bacteria. Or I put it in the dishwasher or the washing machine. I am changing that sponge all the time. Because you're just spreading bacteria through your house. Oh, my kitchen is so clean.
And if you took some, I just wiped it down with my sponge.
There you go. And I spread bacteria everywhere. After being a grossologist, there are certain things like my kitchen. I'm a freak. It's got to be like spotless. And my refrigerator and my where you shower, your sinks and stuff. Because I just have all this info in my head.
My dad said that when he was in college, one of his professors, if you borrowed his pen, he would say, oh, just keep it.
Oh, my.
He didn't want it back. Or if you walked up to a doorknob, he would put his hand in his pocket to turn the doorknob so he wouldn't have to touch it.
I wear a really long sleeve when I'm traveling, clothes with really long sleeves, so I can open doors without touching, or the escalator. Yeah.
Sylvia, you know too much.
I know. I have too much info in my head. Just wash your hands a lot. You'll be fine.
But now you do have, on page 72 in this book, how to grow your own bacteria.
Oh, yeah. I've done that experiment a lot with my students so that they could find out where they would really find the bacteria. Because they don't believe me when I say it's not on the toilet seat, that I'd be more likely to be on the taps. And so we would go and we would swab or look at places to grow our own bacteria. This one, it's a bouillon broth that is used here, and some gelatin to make your own plates, because we use real auger plates in school. And what you're going to do is you're going to go ahead and make your own auger plates with the bouillon and the gelatin. And what I had kids do is just leave it on the back of the toilet seat, or leave it, you know, in the kitchen and see what collects, and find out what grows by covering them up, obviously, and letting them grow. But you can also swab places just with a cotton swab, and put it on the gelatin, see what grows. And you'll find out your least likely places are the places that are least likely, not to me, but to many people, where you're going to grow the most bacteria.
Well, along those lines, too, you would think that, boy, a dog's mouth must be the worst place in the world for all kind of little critters that you don't want. And you have a chapter on kissing.
Oh, I think that chapter is so funny.
And you say you're better off kissing your dog than another human.
Right, because dogs actually have an enzyme inside of their mouths that are going to kill off a whole lot of bacteria and stuff that is inside of a dog's mouth, which makes sense. Because if a dog gets a wound, they're going to lick their wounds. And you don't want to be adding bacteria to your wounds. They can't go wash it in the sink. They don't have thumbs. Whereas human mouths, our mouth is so full of bacteria. It's unbelievable. And your dog's is less so unless it just ate kitty poo. Then it's going to have kitty poo bacteria in it. So your dog is much better off kissing you than
your dog than
than another human. We don't really listen to that advice, though.
No, but and you also talk about puppies, because I was thinking about people don't mind, you know, getting a lick from a little puppy. And you talk about dog
puppies
breath.
Puppies have terrible breath.
Well, sometimes puppies, before they get their permanent teeth, their breath is rather sweet.
Sweet? Oh, I think it's nasty. I don't like puppy breath at all.
Well, you do have a chapter on dog breath, and why do dogs have bad breath?
A lot
of times, we didn't know.
As if you didn't know. Why dogs' breath stinks.
That's the name of this this chapter.
It's pretty funny. Well, it really is going to depend upon what they just ate. And so, you know, like I said, if they ate some poops, then they're going to have some pretty bad breath. And then dogs actually, nowadays, people do take their dogs in to get their teeth cleaned. And part of that, though, is because our dogs eat, again,
human food.
Human processed food. Mm. And they don't chew on bones. So chewing on bones is going to take all that tartar and stuff that we get on our teeth from not chewing on bones. They're going to get that as well. And so their breath is going to end up being pretty nasty.
Well, in fact, I had two little dogs that were littermates, so they had the same genetic heritage. One of them got tartar much faster. We had to have her teeth cleaned much more often because she would bolt her food. The other one would chew her food.
Yeah.
And the one that would just bolt it was the one whose teeth didn't get scrubbed by the chewing. And she had to
and
have
so
her
then
teeth
they're going to have their teeth cleaned.
Yeah.
Or they can chew bones. Now, they have those, you know, the chew bones that they can use to get the tartar off their teeth. Mm-hmm. Because my dog, Poco, she loves us. She thinks they're the best.
My guest is Sylvia Brancy, and she currently, there's an exhibit of her Science of Gross Things at the Gateway Science Museum in Chico. And we might mention that people, if they are curious about your exhibit, it will be, the exhibit is, the Gateway Science Museum is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon to 5 p.m. You can, of course, go online and take a look there. And this exhibit will be in place. It's for the spring until the 8th of May. So you might want to go by and see Professor Nigel Knows It All, for example, and find out what he has to say about allergies and colds. Now, we've been talking about your books on grossology because that's what you're most known for.
Right.
But you have some books that I find fascinating, and you call these Rebel in a Dress. And this is such a departure from your usual books and your field of microbiology that I was curious, how did you start writing books in this series, Rebel in a Dress? You might guess that these are women who didn't follow the path that said, here's what is expected of a woman.
Yeah, it's about independent women in history. Funny how things come along. I thought of grossology clipping my toenails, and Rebel in a Dress came along. Jack and I were working on the Ixtry.
Jack is who your illustrator.
My illustrator.
Jack
my illustrator and I, we were working on the Ixtry books, and I was lying in bed one night thinking about pirates, and...
So there's the connection. You went from icky things to icky things in history to the history of independent women.
Well, I was there, and I was thinking about pirates, which... we never did do. And I was like, wow, were there any girl pirates? Can I name a woman pirate? And I was like, I can't. And I was like, wait a minute, Sylvia, you have a science background. Can you name 10 women in history?
And before you go any farther, there is a woman pirate.
Yes, and... I found a few, finally.
Because a local author wrote a story about this, about a woman pirate.
Which one?
Bonnie.
Yeah, Bonnie.
You knew about her.
Yes.
Yeah. And of course, there are women who people didn't know were women until they died. And
right.
They dressed them for the funeral. And,
found out they were
Charlie.
Women.
Yeah, but you could see why people would do that. If you're not able to vote because of your gender,
right.
You just change your clothes,
right,
and you get to vote.
Yeah, they believe that that was the first woman's vote way back then, was a woman disguised as a man who went and voted because basically she'd been a man for a long time.
Yeah, so when we think we give the year that women first got the vote, yeah, you just winked one eye because
it wasn't the right year.
Yeah,
but
because
nobody
knows? Who knows when women actually did vote?
Exactly, because they would disguise themselves as men.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how this came about. I got frustrated. Lying in bed. I was lying in bed, actually. I couldn't name 10 women scientists.
So you first thought, well, I can't name any women pirates. And now you can name some women scientists.
I could, but I couldn't name 10.
Yeah, that's...
I mean,
yeah.
I could, if I went into ones that I'd done research with.
There's Madame Curie, and then there's nobody.
No, then you go Jane Goodall, and you do...
Oh, well, yeah, modern day, but they... are not in the lab with chemicals. These are women who go out and observe animals and tell us,
But I still couldn't name 10, so then I got frustrated and I thought, oh my goodness, this is ridiculous. And at the time, it was like, I call them the belly button girls, you know, the pop singers who I showed their belly buttons. And I said, oh my goodness, they're the biggest thing out there. And my granddaughter was like 9. And I said, wait, those are terrible role models. I'll just write books.
Now, speaking of granddaughters, you actually have, it's not the same granddaughter because this granddaughter is only about 3 and a half.
She's 3 and a half.
You have a granddaughter here in Chico.
I do.
So you can be with your exhibit and be with family here in Chico.
Exactly. So she's going to see my exhibit tomorrow.
Oh, I'd be curious to what a 3-year-old sees.
I know. Sometimes they get scared. Uh-huh. I've only met one that got scared, my friend's kid. Just because the animatronics are giant.
Oh, yeah, that faucet. Professor Nigel Knows It All is huge.
But in general, they just, gross algae is loud and cuckoo and fun. So they end up just wanting to go back over and over and over and go to the exhibit again and again and again because there's so much to explore within the exhibit.
Okay, so back to your Rebel in a Dress series you have on your cover. And who is an example of a woman rebel?
Well, there are many. Well, Annie Oakley's probably one of the most famous. And so she's on the cover of the Cowgirl book. And Annie Oakley actually, to this day, they don't quite know why. I mean, she truly was an amazing shot. And they think that it was because her eyesight was just a little better than most everybody else's. This, now I'm back in science. It's not in the book. But and some people, you're born with your twitch muscles. Twitch muscles is how fast you respond to things. And you can't really develop it. You're born with it, and she was probably born with very fast twitch muscles.
So good eyesight and good twitch muscles, and she could outshoot just about anybody.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was all documented.
So Annie Oakley is on your cover in this series, Rebel in a Dress. It says about women heroes who would not accept the gender limits of their times, whether becoming the sharpest shooter in the country like Annie Oakley or the best barrel racer in rodeo history like Charmaine James. It took more than knowledge of riding horses to be a true cowgirl. And this is your series on cowgirls. You said, with adventure in their blood and determination in their hearts, these women and others push past the boundaries of society, the day, and themselves to earn their place in history. So when you say women of adventure, that's another book you have, Rebel in a Dress, Adventurers. And who's on the cover of your book of Adventurers?
Is Amelia Earhart.
Yeah, that's pretty adventurous.
Yeah, she was pretty adventurous. There's actually some that were more adventurous than she.
Who would you consider more adventurous?
Well, because there was this other lady named Bessie Coleman. And so she was a black woman who wanted to fly. And so she had to go to France in order to learn how to fly. And then she came back to the U.S., and they wouldn't hire her to do any flying, really. Because, well, A, because she was black, and she was a woman. She had a double whammy. So she ended up doing shows for people. She actually died, though, in a show performing.
And these one of the women in your book called the series, Rebel in a Dress, Adventurers. And you've got a couple of these books, Rebel in a Dress, and the graphics, I really enjoyed. They're so creative. The way the cover of your book, for example, you mentioned Annie Oakley's on the cover of The Cowgirls, and Amelia Earhart is on the cover of Adventurers. But the inside, too, how did you come up? Was that because you have a different illustrator,
right?
For this,
Melissa Sweet did the beginning chapter pictures, and what we were looking for is we were looking for a collage look because I love
it does.
Collage,
mm-hmm.
and I worked very closely with the editors on this book, so they made sure that it had the collage look that we were going for. The point being that it almost looks like it would be a scrapbook.
In fact, so the little post-it notes are so realistic. I almost thought, oh, here's a post-it note stuck in this book.
You know, it's really funny because when I wrote the Grossology books and I was first going around for interviews for those books, I often was interviewed and people would say, but a girl wrote this book.
Oh.
And I was like, well, yeah.
Does that matter?
And I got that from dozens of interviewers in the beginning.
In fact, that's why a lot of women just use their initials, so it doesn't reveal the gender.
Oh, I was going for that. I was going to push it home because it's like, yeah, a girl can love science and love to learn about gross stuff. It's not just for males. Anybody is curious. And so originally when I was performing Grossology, I first dressed like really crazy for interviews, you know, like a mad scientist. And I had a man in L.A. who he did publicity stuff, I guess. And he said to me, get rid of the crazy clothes. I want you to look nice. I want you to wear a skirt or a dress. And when you get on stage, I want crazy things to come out of your mouth because they do. And he said, and I want the young girls in the audience to know that they can do what you do. Mm-hmm. That there's nothing wrong with being smart and interesting and a scientist, and you can talk about gross stuff just like anybody else. And I took his advice, and I've had so many young girls write me letters or send me emails saying that I opened up their world because I was a woman in the field I went into. So I guess there was a kind of a hidden part of the Rebel in a Dress, mm-hmm. which was my own background I had gone through when I first wrote Grossology, because it never entered my mind that I shouldn't do it because I was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it entered a lot of other people's minds.
So besides being a New York Times bestselling author, you are a role model for young women.
I hope so.
What a nice...
I really hope so.
That is nice. And you're so creative with the books and the topics you come up with. What are you working on now?
It's really funny. I am... I'm not writing anything. My husband and I bought an old Mormon church that we are renovating and fixing up and living in all at the same time. So it's taken over my entire life. So I haven't been doing much writing because I am now painting a lot.
Well, I just imagine that something will come
of
this renovation that you'll say one day, the little light bulb will go off over your head and say, ah, while I'm renovating this church, I know what my next book will be.
Exactly. That's how it happens for me anyway.
Thank you, Sylvia. It's been such a treat.
Thank you. It's been fun.
My guest has been Sylvia Branzi, and she has a series of books on Grossology, Ixtery, and Rebel in a Dress. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.